This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why the world of modern surfing owes a debt to Wisconsin. Now it's less than a week until Halloween, so you might want to get moving on your holiday shopping. And I'm not talking about the candy for the trick-or-treaters. Experts in supply chain management say the ongoing shipping crisis is going to make shopping difficult. Why? There are fewer workers making stuff and fewer people gathering the materials to make said stuff. Then there are fewer workers to move that stuff from point A to point B. And consumers are expected to increase their spending compared to the previous 2 years. So, might be a good idea to do your shopping now so you can get what you want and have it in time for the big day, or make other less stuff-oriented plans. Some experts say the disruptions are largely the pandemic's fault, but there were some issues even before COVID-19 came on the scene. So what's it going to take to fix the supply chain, and when might that happen? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been feeling the shipping woes? Have you started your holiday shopping? If you work in shipping, in the shipping industry or transportation, what are you seeing? If you drive a truck, what's that like right now? If you run a business, have you had a hard time getting the things you want to sell or to make what you want to sell? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Peter Luxis is a senior lecturer of supply chain management with the Granger Center for Supply Chain Management at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Pete, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Great to be with you.
I've said the phrase supply chain a lot in recent days. What do we mean exactly when we say supply chain?
That's a great question. Every product really has a supply chain. And I think of a supply chain as not a linear line, but a network of manufacturers, of growers, of factories, of carriers, ocean carriers like container ships and airplanes, of ports, of order fulfillment centers like Amazon. And then finally, retail stores where we do our shopping, and finally the end consumer. So it's end to end, all the way from the point of supply to the point of demand. And hopefully it runs somewhat invisibly. Of course, that's not happening now.
What are some of the biggest reasons you see for why that network of chains has got a little tangled?
Yeah. I mean, there's not one single reason. You know, most visibly, we see the Port of LA, Long Beach right now, the two ports with the backup. And, you know, they were under a lot of COVID pandemic restrictions. So the throughput is not quite as high as normal. I looked at the volumes just before coming on here, and we're at 900,000 TEUs, or 20-foot equivalent units, at the port, which is a record, actually, in terms of volume. So things are moving, but there's kind of links all the way down the supply chain. So at the rail yards, there's a trucker shortage right now as well. There's just a multitude of reasons for this, what I would call a traffic jam.
This came up during the pandemic. How much can we say it's because of the pandemic?
It's partly because of the pandemic. I mean, we think back a year ago, we had shortages on PPE and on masks and things like that. We've gotten through that. But what happened really is the consumption and the demand of American consumers has changed. Before we wanted a lot of services. We wanted to go to Disney. We wanted to go to the Wisconsin Dells, to indoor water parks. And of course, we shifted that demand to home goods, to our home offices, to electronics. And unfortunately, when that happened, when we had this, not going to Disney, all the ocean carriers canceled their lanes. They shortened their schedules, as well as the air carriers. And it took a while for this to come back. And, you know, that was one of the root causes of this backup that we're seeing right now.
Is this a United States problem, or could we be having this conversation in a lot of other countries at this time?
Well, it's hitting us harder than a lot of other countries right now, frankly. The ports of Shanghai and other Southeastern Asian ports, they were closed, during the pandemic for as long as a week or longer, which had some backups. But, you know, this is largely hitting the U.S. really hard at our Western ports.
One thing I saw around the 9/11 attacks and at a couple other points since then is, we have this really lean distribution model. If I own a business anywhere on that chain, I don't want to have a lot of inventory sitting around. I want to have what I could sell and move tomorrow. So when there's a disruption, it can really slow things down. How big a piece of the puzzle is that?
That's a huge piece of the puzzle. And you brought up a key word there, inventory. So a lot of the U.S. businesses really ran down their inventories, and now they're trying to build them back up again. So this is a big part of this. Businesses may be at 50%, 75% of their inventory levels where they want to be to satisfy consumer demand. So they're ordering a lot. There's a lot of orders coming in as well as e-commerce orders as well, which logistically take a lot more intensity for that last mile to provide logistically.
Talking to Peter Luxas, Senior Lecturer of Supply Chain Management at UW-Madison School of Business. We are talking about the supply chain, the supply chains around the world, why they're slowing down, and why it might mean if you're looking for a present to give to somebody in December, you might want to get on it now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been buying stuff that's been taking a long time to arrive in your line of work, in your business? Are you having trouble getting needed supplies? Or are you getting them, but it costs a little more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Pete, early in the pandemic, toilet paper was probably the poster child for disrupted supply chain. What kind of consumer goods are you looking at right now that people might notice in their daily lives?
I would say anything with... Well, first of all, I would say pretty much everything, but my second answer would be anything with semiconductor chips in. And these chips are in a lot of stuff. They're in a lot of our toys right now, kids' toys that talk. Obviously, they're in our cars. They're in our laptops. So any type of consumer electronic type of item. You know, we've seen recently a shortage on even diapers, gloves, medical gloves. Again, there's some shortages with the latex of those, and obviously cars as well.
With a complicated product like those semiconductors and the computer chips, can you talk about how complex those supply chains in particular are?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, if we go back a decade or so, the trend in the U.S. really was to outsource to foundries, the manufacturing of these semiconductor chips. So a lot of companies like Intel, that was their strategy to still design the chips within the U.S., but the manufacturing was occurring largely in two countries. So Samsung in South Korea and then the Taiwan chip company. So now the strategy has shifted to moving some of this manufacturing back to the U.S., which I think is a good thing because it will give us some more control over a supply chain. But it takes a couple of years to build these foundries and billions of dollars.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Sun Prairie. Mike, hi.
Hi. Hey, I was reading a couple of articles over the last couple of weeks, and a lot of them they said that there was a lack of automation at these two ports in California, and they rank honestly like in the bottom of the world as far as efficiency and speed. Just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Mike, thanks for the call. Are we under automated at our big ports in this country?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if we look globally, and you know, let's look at like Chinese ports, Shanghai, for example, largest port in the world in terms of volume, there is much more automation at those ports. Also, there's I would say a lower level of safety rules, so therefore there can be more output. One of the metrics we look at is the number of moves per hour at a port. And Asian ports, are usually well over 100 moves, even high 100 moves per hour. So that's either picking up a container, setting a container down in the port. I haven't looked at the recent statistics at LA, but I would say, maybe one third of that that processing speed due to lower levels of automation. And of course, there has to be a balance working with labor, working with the unions to come up with an equitable balance.
Thanks for that call, Mike. I also wonder, I assume these Chinese ports are newer, and it'd be a lot easier to build a new port with automation than to go to an existing big port and retrofit new things. Am I just making that up, or is that part
no,
of the story?
No, that's part of the story. And in 2008, 2009, during the recession, a lot of the countries like China put invested a lot of money into their infrastructure, into their airfields, into their ports. But it is very, very expensive. I think that is something we could look at in the U.S. as well, too.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who said she had heard that the port of Chicago was being looked at as an entry point for more goods. We've also seen Florida Governor Ron DeSantis saying, hey, ships, come to Florida, avoid the traffic jams at these big ports like in California. And I think Savannah is another big one. How easy is it to just say, let's bring in ships at different ports?
I think there's a few things to think about. So Chicago is not a bad option because it's one of the largest intermodal hubs in the country. And so intermodal meaning transferring a container from a rail directly to truck or from water directly to truck. We have to keep in mind, like the port of Milwaukee, for example, closer to us in Wisconsin, just has Lakers coming in. It's pretty unusual to have any type of container ship coming into the port of Milwaukee. We might see road salt or something like that this time of year. Down in Florida, that's a little different story. I think you can get ships as large as 8,000 to 9,000 TEUs at Tampa Bay. The largest container ships out there are about 18,000 or 19,000. So you're only getting about kind of half size container ships in Florida. The other thing that just comes to mind too is, you know, the port is one thing, but then there's the terminals and the warehouses just off the port and the short haul providers or the drayage providers. You have to line up these third party logistics companies. You have to line up the warehouses. You have to have a distribution center. So if you're a big box retailer and you already have one in the Southeast, you probably could divert some freight to say Savannah or Southeast area. So I don't think it's a bad idea, but there are some other constraints as you said.
We're talking about disruptions in the global supply chain with Peter Luksis. He's a senior lecturer of supply chain management at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Still time for your calls, thoughts, and questions at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered the broken supply chain one way or another? A longer than expected wait for something to show up? A store shelf that didn't have the thing you thought it would? Or if you're in business, how is this affecting you? Truckers love to hear from you as well, how this is affecting your gig. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're talking about global supply chain problems and why it's getting harder to get certain things. And when we do find it on a shelf somewhere, you can often expect to pay more for it. Peter Luksis stays with us, senior lecturer of supply chain management at UW-Madison's Wisconsin School of Business. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Pete, before we go back to callers, is this something that is just going to kind of sort itself out over time, or are big interventions going to be needed at various points along the chain?
I think we're going to need some bolder interventions, and we're starting to do some with the 24/7 port operations. We're seeing some businesses starting to charter their own ships. So Target, Walmart, Costco, big box retailers. You know, this is a bold move. I haven't heard of this before, where they, you know, it started kind of as a joke from what I heard at these companies, but they're chartering some small container ships, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 TEUs, and then they're taking them in ports around LA. So I think, you know, bypassing the LA area, possibly also pivoting more from ocean to air transportation could be another strategy to get us through this.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. I was thinking about the situation of making chips here in America, and it seems to me that if you build a new chip factory in 2 years, and then supply chips, they'd probably be at a higher price than the ones from Asia, and you might be at a competitive disadvantage, and eventually you might want to move your supply overseas again for the same reason as before. I also was thinking about, I was told at least back in the old days, that Bushnell Company was kept in the binocular business by the U.S. government so that we'd have binoculars no matter what in a war. And that leads me to the question of what should the government do to make it possible for people to do things like build chip factories in America?
John, thanks for the call. What do you think, Pete? I know we've done similar things for steel and aluminum over the years, looking at chips as a strategic supply. And what could the government do to promote production here in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, first to the caller's question on insourcing within the U.S. and reshoring, what could be gained is really more control of the supply chain and perhaps better quality. From a cost perspective, the labor costs are going to be cheaper overseas. The building cost probably would be a little cheaper as well too. But the total landed cost of with the shipping and in terms of the inventory and the control and quality of the processes, I think we could be fairly competitive. Maybe on par or a little bit more. But then in the end, I think that could be a good move.
John, thanks for the call. We'll go to Artemis now in Appleton. Artemis, hi.
Hi. You were asking about people who had experienced supply chain disruption, and our refrigerator broke 2 months ago, and we're still waiting on one to come in. We've been living out of a mini fridge for the last 2 months because we went to multiple stores, and they told us Halloween at the earliest for we needed a smaller fridge. So they had the larger ones in stock, but sort of the starter home size fridges, they're 2 or 3 months out on being able to get those in.
Artemis, thanks a lot for sharing that story. He's not alone, I'm guessing, Peter.
Yeah, it's hopefully he won't need to be putting stuff outside in Lake Winnebago and in Appleton to keep things cold in the ice box. But yeah, it's not looking too good right now with a lot of things like refrigerators, because there's so many different components that go into the refrigerator. So, I mean, if you're missing one component, and there are a lot of chips as well too, you're not able to get that refrigerator out of the factory. So I think what we're going to probably see is just a lot less variety with refrigerators and parts like that, or products like that. We're not going to have as many different options to choose from in the future. But, you know, I would say, hang on. Our refrigerator went down too, and I had a dorm-sized refrigerator in our kitchen for a while before I could get one.
Thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, my fridge died, but then came back to life. Knock on wood, it sticks around till this is all through. Thanks for that call, Artemis. We are talking about supply chain problems with Peter Luxis from the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Spooner. Bill, hi.
Hello. Nice program. I happen to be waiting for garage doors to complete a large garage I've just built, and it's specifically the torsion springs that make the doors go up and down. And I'm wondering if going back a few years, there was a big disruption in steel pipeline from the Trump tariffs and trade embargoes. And I'm just wondering if to what degree, if any, that lingering, those problems, those disruptions are playing a role now.
Wow. Bill, thanks for the call. For want of a spring, the garage was lost. Pete, what's happening with that kind of product?
Right. How we would think about that one is it's really more of a logistics problem and a supply chain traffic jam than it is a tariff issue here with putting up, you know, different tariffs on imports of steel and manufacturing. From what I was reading, the manufacturing is going. It's, you know, the steel parts are going out the door. It becomes more of a supply chain issue because these are very heavy things to ship. They're shipping via rail, via ocean. You know, you can't really put them on airplanes to do it too cost effectively. So unfortunately, they're lower priority things right now in the supply chain, and it could be a little while.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Graham is with us in Madison. Graham, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I saw an article this morning. I didn't read it, and it was, I planned to, but it was entitled, "If you want to clear up some of the congestion at the port, start by repealing the Jones Act." I don't even know what that is and if it's relevant. I just was kind of curious if you had any comments about that.
The Jones Act, Pete. Are you familiar with that? So it has to do with regulating shipping?
Regulating shipping, the Jones Act. I've heard of it before, but you know, I don't quite know how it plays in. It regulates maritime commerce in the United States. Yeah, I, Sorry, I don't have an answer for you on that one.
That's okay. Thanks for the call. Something we can look into more. As we wrap up, Pete, what are you watching for next to see if some of the solutions you're hoping for actually start to come online?
Well, I think what we're playing right now is a game of whack-a-mole. If you remember that game, like in the arcade, and now they have Hasbro has tabletop whack-a-mole games. We're playing a game of supply chain whack-a-mole, where, you know, first it was the ports, and now it's the rail lines getting backed up. We also have a trucker shortage as well too. That's something we didn't really talk about today. I think what to look for next here is, I think there's going to be a lot more limited assortment. I think manufacturers are going to start limiting their assortment, you know, fewer options of diapers, fewer options of laptops, fewer options of phones, and simplification. I think supply chain simplification is going to be a theme that's going to be better for the supply chain. It may not be as great for the customer in terms of options, but at least we'll have better availability.
And briefly, Pete, you mentioned supply chains are best when they're kind of invisible. That said, are you appreciating getting extra attention maybe from your students, colleagues, and us here in the media when it's not invisible?
Well, just in class last week, we put up the Port of LA in a GPS feed, and we were counting the number of container ships out there. And I think we counted like 50 or 60 that were anchored, another 20 or something that were adrift. And, you know, I think anyone that's even, you know, loosely affiliated with supply chain is getting a lot of attention today. So, you know, it's a, I hope to get more students in the classroom, and we definitely need more in the supply chain field. I think it's a great profession.
Pete, thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
That's Peter Luxas, Senior Lecturer of Supply Chain Management at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about the global supply chain disruptions out there, how it could all affect our upcoming holiday shopping, and what it would take to fix it. Still time for you to share problems you've encountered as a consumer, as a person in business, or in transportation of goods. Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can always tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent on this week's edition of Ask a Contractor. It's in the can with a look at toilet repair and maintenance. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a nonpartisan review of the 2020 election found no widespread fraud in Wisconsin, but did issue a set of recommendations to improve elections administration in the state. We'll talk to one of the Republican lawmakers who ordered the audit about the results and what comes next. Now, a new exhibit at the Washburn Area Historical Society Museum celebrates a man known as the godfather of modern surfing, who just happens to be from Wisconsin. Tom Blake was born in Milwaukee in 1902 and grew up in Washburn. He would go on to totally revolutionize the world of surfing. The design of modern surfboards is thanks largely to Tom Blake. So is the style of contemporary surfing photography, those photos that make you feel like you're riding the wave with the surfer. And that chill, hang-loose attitude, that was born and bred Wisconsinite Tom Blake as well. We have another Tom Blake with us, the nephew of surfing legend Tom Blake. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
What do you remember most about your uncle?
Well, for me personally, I really didn't get to know him till he was in his later years. And I mostly remember him just being a real humble, very quiet. A lot of what I know about him, I learned after he passed away. And so he didn't talk much about his accomplishments, but he was very quiet, very kind person. Didn't have a lot to say about it. So like I said, I learned a lot of what I know about him after he passed away.
Yeah. How did you realize what a legend your humble uncle was down the road?
Well, my wife and I had made a trip to Hawaii, and we were staying in a hotel and went down to the gift card shop, and there were postcards with his picture on it and talking about it. And so we visited a lot of the surf shops there and found all kinds of stuff. And then I started collecting, anything I could get my hands on about him. And that's where I really, learned the most that I did doing it that way.
And there's a pandemic echo here. I understand he got into surfing after he dropped out of high school during the 1918 flu pandemic. Can you talk about what led this kid from Wisconsin into the world of surfing?
Yeah, he had mentioned that he saw a Newsreel clip when he was 9 or 10 years old in Washburn, and it showed Hawaiian surfers at Waikiki, and that really struck with him. And then when he left Washburn during the pandemic, he went to stay with some relatives in Detroit, and he met Duke Kanemoroko, and his teammates were coming back from the Antwerp Olympics in a movie theater. They were showing highlights of their performance there, and he went up and introduced himself and said that Duke was, you know, very accommodating, and Tom kind of took that as an invitation to come see him. So 4 years later, he took a steamship to Hawaii, and Duke wasn't on the island at the time, but Tom got connected with his brothers, and Sam Kanemoroko in particular, and surfed with them and swam with them. And he only stayed for about a year, and he went back to California, where he had moved shortly after meeting Duke in 1920. And he started competitively swimming there, and made another trip a couple of years later to Hawaii. And then he went back there pretty much every year for the next 30 years, other than the war years. But he, while he was in Hawaii, he spent a lot of time at Bishop Museum studying the old ancient Hawaiian boards, and started to experiment with those boards were huge and very, very heavy. And he started experimenting with first drilling holes in them to make them lighter, and then making kind of hollow chambers. And he ended up, you know, creating much lighter, faster boards and set all kinds of surfing race records in Hawaii. And that's kind of how he got over there to begin with.
And surfing had been around, of course, for thousands of years on Pacific islands. Did the changes Tom made to the board and things like that help it catch on elsewhere in the world?
Absolutely. The lighter weight boards, I think the older boards were, you know, 100, 150 pounds. And ultimately he got the board down to, I think, about 50 pounds or less. So it certainly introduced it, made it feasible for women and children to take up surfing. And it made it much easier to manufacture, you know, eventually when the veneer finishes and it made for, mass production of the board. So it definitely did promote surfing from where it had been.
And also surfing photography. Your uncle Tom Blake made a big difference there. What was his innovation?
Well, he invented a waterproof camera housing, and then he started taking pictures from the surfboard. And he was first published in National Geographic in 1935 as an article titled Waves and Thrills on Waikiki that had a bunch of his pictures, and it showed people in Waikiki doing tandem surfing and just kind of, glorified the sport of surfing and brought a lot of attention to it. And his photography got a lot of publications in some, you know, major publications on the mainland that kind of spurred the interest in surfing over here.
We often think of surfing, modern surfing, as having kind of that chill, hang loose attitude. Was that an innovation of your uncle as well?
Well, I don't know about an innovation, but he definitely reflected, I think, that lifestyle that you think of. He was very extremely handsome, I guess, and tanned, and had the surfer's physique, and he also had the kind of carefree attitude, surf all day, and he kind of worked different jobs. He would lifeguard. He would, he actually, when he was in California surfing, he did acting jobs. He was in several movies when he was out there, but he would just make enough money to surf for another month or two. And then, you know, he'd get another job. And he lived pretty much out of his van, didn't have a lot of material things. So I think he kind of embodied that hang loose culture.
I got to ask, Tom, did Wisconsin surfing legend ever take his nephew, Tom, to try to introduce him to surfing?
Well, he took me and my brothers out on Chemaumegan Bay on Lake Superior a couple of different times when we were younger. And we never did have that skill that he had. We enjoyed going out there and visiting with him mostly because we didn't get to see him a lot. But none of us were watermen, that's for sure.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks. Thank you.
Tom Blake. He talked to us about his uncle, the Wisconsin surfing legend Tom Blake. The Washburn Historical Society Museum has an exhibit about the surfer Tom Blake. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about family names.
In most cities and towns, there are last names that stick out. Maybe the family has lived there for generations, perhaps they're notorious, or maybe they own a well-known business. For writer Sandy Reitman of Milwaukee, her semi-famous last name sticks out mostly thanks to her beloved uncle.
As a kid, I woke up to the sound of my uncle's voice on my little white FM radio alarm clock every morning before school, along with half the city of Milwaukee.
94 WKTI Milwaukee. Reitman and Miller at 5 o'clock. Let me start off your Monday morning.
My Uncle Bob was the Reitman half of Reitman and Miller in the morning on 94.5 WKTI Milwaukee, playing the music of the 80s, 90s, and today for many years. He was a big voice with a unique last name in a small city. But the last name didn't start its recognition there. My grandfather, Robert Reitman Sr., was an FBI agent and served as commissioner of the Whitefish Bay Police and Fire Department, so his name was known about town. His namesake son, Bob, the radio host, was the total anti-culture of his father, becoming somewhat of a civil rights movement activist and the city's original hipster. His career started on public radio, then on to underground radio, to morning radio, and now full circle back to public radio. His listeners have loyally followed him along the way, also remembering the Reitman last name. The first time I remember learning that it was unusual to have your uncle on the radio was when my elementary school music teacher repeated a fact that she had learned about me on the radio that morning. Maybe it was my birthday or something, I can't really remember, but I was beyond confused and embarrassed that this teacher and now my entire class could learn things about me on the radio. After school, I talked to my parents about how it all works, and I soon became much more interested in the fame that came with my name than whatever was bothering me earlier. My big brother, Kevin, was an active Boy Scout around that time and took his whole troop with him to the WKTI radio studio for some kind of patch earnings activity. I, of course, tagged along with all the boys. I remember being in the sound production room while the troop was in the studio, amazed to see how radio works behind the scenes. This was my first backstage moment of my life. My parents were used to the "Are you related to Bob Reitman?" question as they grew up hearing it. My dad had the little brother complex, but also made his own name for himself. As I got older, my friend's parents started to ask me more about my uncle and what's he really like, and I would engage their questions. But around town, he was just a likable guy. When I was old enough to make purchases with a debit card, cashiers would ask me, "Are you related to Bob Reitman?" And I would oblige this question from strangers because I was proud to be his niece. I ran off to New York City for 10 years, only to get a couple "Are you related to Ivan or Jason Reitman?" questions. A famous Hollywood directorial family of which I'm not related to, but occasionally would lie and say I was just to get the reaction. When I moved back to Milwaukee in my early 30s, I noticed that the Reitman question came up less and less. I started to miss being asked it, actually. Recently, this whole saga came full circle when someone asked my dad, "Are you Bob Reitman's son?" That was all the validation my dad needed after years of being the disc jockey's little brother. I recently reconnected with my elementary school art teacher, also a Milwaukee native who listened to my uncle her whole life. She told me a story where she was talking about Reitman on the radio, and whomever she was speaking to said, "Oh, like Sandy Reitman?" Full stop, full circle. I had officially moved from BTS to VIP status. So, what's in a semi-known German-Jewish last name in a big, small city like Milwaukee? For me, it's a sense of pride and an even bigger sense of comfort. We Reitmans are at home when in Milwaukee.
Sandy Reitman is a writer who lives in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, Republican State Representative Samantha Kirkman joins the show to break down the results of a recently released nonpartisan review of the 2020 election in Wisconsin. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A nonpartisan review of the 2020 election in Wisconsin was released last week, and it found no evidence of widespread voter fraud. But the Legislative Audit Bureau did release a list of dozens of changes it says could improve the way elections are run in the state. Our next guest was one of the lawmakers who ordered the audit earlier this year. Samantha Kirkman is a Republican who represents Wisconsin's 61st Assembly District, which includes Western Kenosha County. She's also co-chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. Representative Kirkman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
What's your main takeaway from this extensive report?
Well, I appreciate the work of the Audit Bureau. It's 110 pages that they have given to us. And so there is a lot of detail and a lot of things that, you know, we're working through right now to try to analyze and figure out. There were 30 findings and 18 recommendations for legislation. Some of those things, revolve around training, revolve around how the ballots are handled through the absentee process, just many different things that have given us a blueprint for going forward.
State Senator Rob Coles, your co-chair on the Joint Audit Committee, tweeted last week that the report shows the election was, quote, largely safe and secure, end quote. Do you agree with that? A brief summary of his tweet?
Well, you know, again, many different things were found by this audit. So, again, things for legislative consideration, things that the legislature has already been considering. When we gave them the scope of the audit, there were four main areas that we wanted them to look at. It was the statewide voter registration list, which is called WisVote. It found that there are many challenges with that. In particular, you know, how they're maintained and who maintains them. The absentee ballots, questioning, you know, the special deputies, you know, when absentee ballots are given out to nursing homes, questioned, you know, the guidance that was given by WEC, literally went against state statute. So I do think those are serious things that we need to rectify going forward in elections.
In a statement this afternoon, state Senate leaders said the Audit Bureau's report shows, quote, numerous failures within the Wisconsin Election Commission, which undermined the free, fair, and transparent elections Wisconsinites deserve. So some of your Republican colleagues on the Senate side kicking off a new investigation now. Undermined. Do you think that's a strong word, or do you think that it's fair to say that?
Well, I think we need to go forward. Our elections are the foundation of our government. You know, if people don't have faith in our elections, that creates a problem going forward. So we want our constituents, Democrat and Republican, independent, other Green Party people, to have faith in the process. And this is what, you know, their expectation is of legislators are, is to make sure that's happening.
Talking to Representative Samantha Kirkman from the State Assembly, co-chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, looking at a Legislative Audit Bureau report on the 2020 election in Wisconsin. Representative Kirkman, a lot of the recommendations seem to be looking for clear guidance for local election officials, whether it's whether you can use lockboxes or if you can use lockboxes, how to secure them, where they can be, how to handle absentee ballots that don't have complete witness addresses. A lot of clarification things. What stands out to you about things where we just need more clear and consistent rules like that?
Well, you gave two perfect examples that I think the audit gave that blueprint for, in saying, you know, state statute says that you can't, you know, do certain things. And again, WEC gave guidance that was contrary to that. So going forward, we really need to make sure that our statutes are clear. And so this is where we need to sit down and work through these. And it's nonpartisan. You know, that's where I hope that we can find common ground together to put legislation on the governor's desk, and he will be supportive of it.
Let's bring on a caller. Mo is with us in Oconto. Mo, hello.
Yes, I'd like to know why this. It almost seems like a farce how it's a right to vote. It's a duty to vote. And we're actually trying to make it harder to vote. How does that benefit the Wisconsin people when it is a felony when you cast a vote and you're not the legal voter? And how does this benefit the taxpayer?
Well, our foundation of our elections are so critical. I it's the one thing that people want to have faith in. You know, there have been elections that have been decided in my area of the state by one vote. And so going forward, every vote and making sure that vote is accounted for and is legal is really important. You know, making sure our WISC vote or our statewide voter registration list is clean and merged or purged. I'm, for instance, on that list twice. So my maiden name is on there and my married name, but the voter contact or the contact is from 1996. That voter list wasn't created until 2005. So how was it even put on the list? So these are those questions that, again, making sure our lists are, you know, our clerks have clear guidance that follows the state statute, because they're the ones, we have the most decentralized election system amongst our states, because we have 1,800 different municipalities that are running elections. And again, making sure that they have the correct information and the right information that follows state statute.
Thanks for the call, Mo. We'll go to Scott in Menominee. Scott, hi.
Hi. I guess with Ms. Kirkman there on the air and stuff, you know, we've got a lot of legislators in particular in this election review and whatnot that have been in office down there for quite a while. But I want to know, why wasn't this an issue in the last couple election cycles while they're in the office? And I guess I don't want to go much further than that. But
Scott, I gotcha. So the elections commission we have now created came into effect, I think, in 2016. Why mm-hmm. this review now? Why not sooner? I guess he's asking.
So I'll give you an example. So actually, there was a previous audit of the election back in 2014, which several of those recommendations, and actually we had a changed state statute, the former GAB then became what's known as the Wisconsin Elections Commission. So based on the previous audit in 2014 and those recommendations, we created this, you know, what was known as the Government Accountability Board, and determined that the Government Accountability Board wasn't necessarily run efficiently and effectively. So then was created the Wisconsin Elections Commission. So correct, the previous audit in 2014 created what was called WEC now, and so it was a good overview to see if they were actually following the state statutes that are currently on the books.
Thanks for that call. Representative Kirkman, with a lot of issues, Republicans in the legislature want to do one thing. The Democratic governor, Governor Evers, doesn't like it. We end up with a standoff. Do you see room for taking this audit, working together across party lines, and making some of the changes you're hoping for?
Well, I hope so. You know, we have several different, you have the elections committee. We have now our audit committee can take a look at all these findings and put legislation forward. So I hope that we can find common ground and get that across to the governor's desk.
And is there a particular change, again, 100 plus pages, is there a particular change you're really hopeful for?
Well, there's several. I mean, you know, there's 18 legislative findings that we could go forth with different legislation. Different pieces of legislation. So I think there's many different pieces that will, you know, strengthen the system that we have, making it harder to cheat, easier to vote, and go forward from there.
Representative Kirkman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Republican State Representative Samantha Kirkman, who co-chairs the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. She was with us today to talk about the findings out last week from a nonpartisan audit of the 2020 election in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, many communities in the U.S. have seen a jump in shootings in the last 2 years. The creators of the Violence Project are out with a new book. They join the show for a look at the causes and some promising solutions to the problem. And it's a battle for the ages. Which pastry says Wisconsin to you? Is it the cream puff or the Kringle? We'll invite you to join the debate and share your favorite. A lot of people getting started on this on Twitter already, and we have it up on the Ideas Network Facebook page, so you can weigh in now. If you had to pick just one dessert to stand the test of time, is it the cream puff or is it the Kringle? If so, what flavor? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you want to make the case for a whole another candidate, a third party? Let us know. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.